Welcome back to the program as we turn our attention to terror and terrorism. The contemporary war on terror has now been going on for 8 years, and while we've been safe here in America, is the world a safer place, or do we need a radically new approach to dealing with the terrorist threat? Terrorism itself is nothing new. There's a whole history of terrorist violence over the last century. What are the lessons to be learned from that violence, and do our current policies build on that experience? We're going to talk about that today with my guest, Richard English. He's a professor of politics at Queen's University, Belfast, and the author of the award-winning book, Armed Struggle, The History of the IRA. It is my pleasure to have him here to talk about his new work, Terrorism, How to Respond. It's just published by Oxford University Press. Richard English, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you. One of the key points you make is that in order to understand how to deal with terrorism, it is equally important to understand both how we define it and what causes it. Talk a little about that.
I think when you look at most problems which people want to deal with, whether they're the problems of the economy or the problems of health or disease, the key thing that you want people to address is to explain why the problem has arisen, so that you can understand how practically and how effectively to deal with it. So one of my arguments is that while understandably after atrocities like 9/11 or atrocities like we've seen in Northern Ireland over the years, understandably there's an emotional response to say we must condemn this, and I understand why that's done, and we must try and stamp it out in an emotionally high-charged way. What I'm really arguing is that in most serious problems that we face humanly, what we must really do is try and explain why the problem has arisen. And I think probably when crises associated with terrorism arise, we're better at condemning than we are at explaining why it happens. So, for example, it seems to me that most terrorist campaigns involve violence which is entirely unjustifiable, but violence which within the context of disputed legitimacy of the state or disputed issues of power or political disaffection are ones which are not inexplicable. They're not ones where people are doing things which you can't understand. And if you do understand why they happen, you're probably going to be more able to deal with them and to make that kind of horrific violence less likely in the future.
There is this odd notion that enters into the equation too often that says that somehow if we understand the causes of those actions, those terrorist acts, that somehow it gives them legitimacy and credibility. And there's a real disconnect in that.
I think so. I think that's probably the wrong way around. I mean, my argument in my new book on terrorism is that quite often the more closely you look at the arguments which terrorist leaders offer, the less plausible they actually seem. But that what you have to explain is why those kinds of arguments resonate with people in the ways that they do and allow the movements to gain a certain amount of support. So I would argue that actually trying to understand and explain why things happen is not going to give legitimacy. And in the end, it might be that it's the mechanism which allows us to undermine it. Now, if I can give you an example, it's
sure.
Quite often argued that terrorism emerges because of lack of education or because of poverty. Actually, the statistics tend not to back that up. So sometimes we're looking at things where we're explaining things according to the wrong kind of reasons. And if we actually see why people are doing what they're doing, I think we're in a better position to undermine it. So I'm not at all saying we should understand terrorism because I think they have a point. What I'm saying is that most people in most of the cases that I've studied who support terrorism and who engage in it are people who have kind of the same kind of normal responses to things in terms of being rational and emotional in the ways that the rest of us do. And if they're normal people, most of the IRA people that I interviewed, for example, for my book on the IRA, were people who were emphatically normal people with the same kind of responses to things as most people have. If you're explaining why people like that are prepared to do awful things, you have to try to explain what it is about the particular situation and the problem in it which needs to be redressed. And the only way you can actually probably address that is by taking seriously the political complexity of the generative causes behind it.
Of course, the corollary that you talk about early on in the book with that is how we define terrorism itself and what language we use.
I think this is really important. I think one of the key things we need to recognize is that however appalling terrorism is in its awful human consequences, it's best understood, I would argue, as a kind of subspecies of warfare, a kind of warfare that just as in normal war, people who are carrying out the violence understand that the violence is awful but think it's necessary and just to produce a good which is so good you have to fight for it. So too, I think, in terrorism. That's what most terrorist groups think that they're actually doing. In that sense, I'm not hostile to the idea that you should have a war on terrorism. Some people are. I think actually we are involved in a kind of war. My argument is more that we should recognize that this is a war which might might be one in terms of individual groups, but won't be one in terms of ending terrorism as a whole. I think terrorism as such will continue in various different places. While individual terrorist campaigns will come to an end, we won't get rid of it completely. But I think the definition is important, because I think we need to see that terrorizing political violence is something which its practitioners understand essentially as a kind of war, in the same way as states understand what they're doing when they carry out warlike violence. And I think honesty about that point doesn't do us any harm. I think it gains us credibility, because it means that we're responding to something which we explain in ways that might be understood and recognized as being true around the world.
How then should we define it?
I would argue that terrorism is political violence with a psychological dimension, where what you're doing is you're not just targeting the people you attack, but you're trying to communicate to people who watch that attack, who are going to be motivated to change their behavior because of it, that it's something which is about redressing power relations, where people think that power is being wielded against their own community or their interests and they need to change that, and that the only way of doing that is engaging in a kind of warfare which involves terrorizing political violence. I think that kind of definition is one which is more persuasive than, for example, saying that terrorism is something carried out by inexplicable psychopathic fanatics who do things without any particular rationale behind it. There are people like that, but for most of the groups that I've studied, whether it's Basques in Spain or Palestinian terrorists in the Middle East or Irish terrorists or Al-Qaeda, most of the people involved in this violence have a program of things which they want to change and believe that the only way of doing that is through violence. Now, we might think that's entirely unjustified. I do think it's unjustified. We might well think that it's not going to work. I mean, most terrorist groups don't achieve their central goals, but I think the only way we can explain what's going on is to see that they too are engaged in a kind of warfare. If we're involved in a war on terror, they are undoubtedly involved in wars against us and against the states that they oppose.
And if that's the definition, to what extent does that shape how we go about responding to it, either in a political sense or from a law enforcement perspective?
I think both of the things you've just said there, Jeff, are absolutely right. One is that it is something where we have to emphasize the political in terms of explaining why these things happen, and I think in terms of finding a kind of solution to it. In many cases, you can't find an easy solution to these problems, and that's why they go on for so many years. But even in a case as durable as that of Northern Ireland with the IRA, there has been a sense that a political deal eventually could be come to whereby there was a resolution of most of the violence. But the point about police is really important too, because it seems to me that quite often the most effective way of dealing with terrorist violence is to go through the normal procedures of the law and to use police rather than military methods. One of the unfortunate things about responding to terrorist crises is that, quite understandably, states think that a kind of muscular military response is going to be the best thing. Often in history, from the French in Algeria to the British in Belfast, actually to the war on terror involving Iraq and Afghanistan too, often in history what's happened is that the use of military force has had very ambiguous effects in terms of terrorism. Yes, you can stamp out some areas of resistance, but often the military activity that you engage in generates further waves of terrorism because people respond to what they see as foreign military occupation. So I would emphasize that the basic thing is to look at terrorism as something you explain in terms of politics and political problems that generate a conflict, something that you try and address in terms of solving it where possible through political response, but something where you try and catch people and put them in prison through the normal means of the law and through police work. And an awful lot of that can be done. You know, we don't need new laws to say that it's wrong to murder people. We have laws to say that it's wrong to murder people. We don't need to send in the army in order to gain the kind of intelligence about groups that you need to get in order to gain convictions. And I think those are the kind of responses which the US is now moving more towards, and I support that, but which normally come late on in a conflict against terrorism. What I'm arguing is when you have a terrorist crisis, the first thing to go for is to emphasize the political generation of it and then to try and respond through the normal legal mechanisms you have on the statute book.
One of the things that you mentioned repeatedly in talking about the history of terrorism, be it the IRA, the FLN, the Red Army, and some of the other examples, is that these terror campaigns do come to an end.
I think this is one of the encouraging aspects of the long history of terrorism, that people often, understandably, when you look at a crisis, it emerges, whether it's 9/11 or whether it's problems in Chechnya or problems in the former Yugoslavia or wherever, people look and think, oh goodness, this is going to just go on forever. Actually, the vast majority of terrorist campaigns don't last that long, and virtually all of them do come to an end. I think the depressing story is that when one group comes to an end, there are other ones that are starting up, and that is something which we have to face up to and learn to live with. But my book argues that we should face with some confidence the fact that terrorist campaigns do come to an end, and indeed that states tend to be resilient in enduring the threat. I mean, the long history of terrorist experience, whether it be in Western Europe, in the United States, United States, even in the more troubled areas of the Middle East, is that despite the horror that terrorist violence can cause, states are able to contain it in most cases. They are able to carry on kind of civil society mechanisms, and people do get on with resilient lives. And in that sense, I think the tendency is for terrorist violence to be awful, but not to be utterly destructive of the states which they're trying to attack. And in that sense, I think there is some comfort to be taken from the long history of terrorism, too.
In looking at this history, are there patterns that emerge as to how these various waves do come to an end?
I think there are two things I would stress. One is that it's very crucial when you are going to do a deal with terrorist groups that the terrorist group, and in particular its leadership, recognizes that the violence they're thinking is going to produce a victory actually isn't working. In other words, if you've got a terrorist group that still thinks its violence is going to produce victory, you probably can't do a meaningful deal with them. But if they come to the view that they're not producing victory, maybe you can. I think the second thing is that the way that these things tend to end in many, many cases is that sections of the terrorist organization and of their support group gradually become involved in things which are part of their struggle but are not terrorist. And in that sense, I take some comfort from the fact, for example, that groups like Hezbollah or even Hamas have increasingly diversified their operations so that while they do appallingly violent things, they don't only do that. They also get involved in social services, in provision of schools and housing. And I think what happens quite often is that groups move towards emphasizing those non-violent things that they do increasingly, and at that point there's a way of producing political momentum. If I'm right that most people who support terrorism are perfectly normal people, then if you can persuade them that there is an alternative way of achieving political goals and political progress instead of killing people and maiming people, then many people will go for that. And in history, what you often find is that movements that start out as mainly violent movements shift towards more political engagement, towards more social engagement, and that allows you to build relationships which move them away from terrorism towards something less bloody and more fruitful.
Is there a difference then in terrorism that emerges from religious fanaticism versus terrorism that emerges from political grievance?
I would argue that very many of the cases where you have a religious dimension to it also have a grievance about political power and often about nationalism. I mean, I think, for example, if you look at the Palestinian case, clearly there's a strong religious dimension to suicide attacks by Palestinian terrorists. It's also true that it's for many of them about a kind of Palestinian nationalism. Put the other way around, if you look at cases like the Basque group ETA or the IRA, indeed, or loyalists on the Protestant side in Northern Ireland, there was a strong religious dimension to the long histories of those movements, but it's equally true that it was mainly about self-determination for a national group. So in a way, what I would argue is that religion is probably best understood in these crises as something which can't easily be taken out and separated from the other kinds of political dimension. There are some people who will have a kind of religious zealotry, which means that pretty much whatever political arrangement you have won't satisfy them. But I think they're quite few. And it's also important to recognize that the vast majority of people with strong religious beliefs tend not to be engaged in or supportive of terrorism. And I would argue probably that religion has, in history, at least as often, meant that people oppose terrorist violence because of their religious beliefs, as it has pushed them towards it. So I would tend to emphasize the political questions of political legitimacy in disputed areas of political power and see religion as one component of that rather than as something which marks out separate groups.
What about the degree to which terrorism is or is not state-sponsored?
I think this has been a huge problem in two ways. One is that for a long time, and even yet you see it with the role of countries like Iran, for a long time, states were using other kinds of group of terrorists to carry out violence on their behalf. I mean, you saw this in the way that Colonel Gaddafi in Libya would use other groups, including, of course, the IRA, in order to attack his enemies by proxy. And that meant that it was more lethal, it meant that there were better armed groups, it meant that there was more explosive material and there was more funding. And the other dimension to the state question is this, that while we're quite right to identify that non-state terrorism, terrorism by Al-Qaeda, terrorism by Hamas, that this kind of violence is awful and is a real problem. And my book on terrorism is about non-state terrorism. It's also true that throughout history, much, probably most, terrorizing political violence has actually been done by states. If you look at the political violence used by Stalin, the political violence used by Hitler, the political violence sometimes sanctioned by Western powers of whom we would have, for whom we would have great sympathy and support, including our own. We do have to recognize that there have been occasions when terrorizing political violence has been done by states which we would like to support as well as states we don't. And I think that's part of the picture too. If you go to non-state groups and say, you're the terrorists, and they turn around and say, what about the activities that were done by this state or by that state, which looked like terrorizing violence, sometimes they do have a point. And I think what I'm about really is trying to minimize the use of horrific political violence from whichever source it comes. This book is about non-state violence, but I'm also keen to stress that where there is terrorizing political violence by states, that too, of course, creates huge numbers of victims, and I think should be played down and should be stopped wherever possible.
Of course, the flip side of that is that from the terrorist perspective, warfare engaged in by states is to them a form of terrorism.
Absolutely, and this is one of the things which is quite frequently thrown back at states when people complain about terrorism. For example, when Israel complains about Palestinian terrorism, Palestinians will typically say the violence practiced by Israel has a terrorist quality itself. My attempt in my book is to define terrorism in such a way that it recognizes that wherever you have political violence used with a terrorizing dimension to it, you should recognize that that is something which is terroristic. And I think that takes away the sort of abusive use of the term, whereby one side says you're the terrorist and the other side says no, it's not us, it's you. What I would like to say is wherever we have political violence used with terrorizing effect, we should recognize what that is and be honest about it and try and explain why it's come about and where possible try and stop it. I think that if you go to Palestinians and say it's only you that do the terrorism, they will quite legitimately say that some of the violence that's been carried out against them by Israel is indeed political violence used with terrorizing effect, and I think that that's a perfectly reasonable point. What I'm trying to argue is that both kinds of violence used against civilians for political purpose with terrorizing effect is a kind of violence that I would like to see end, because I'm keen on minimizing human suffering rather than just defeating one side or other.
What about the extent to which the level of terrorist violence is escalated today when we see things out there like the possibility, at least, of nuclear terrorism?
I think the most worrying aspect of post-9/11 responses to terrorism has been this, that we're probably now in 2009 no safer from a nuclear-related terrorist attack than we were on the 10th of September 2001. In other words, things haven't changed since 9/11 enough in that regard. I think the danger of a nuclear attack is something less in terms of the likelihood of terrorist groups getting capacity, getting control over nuclear weapons, than of some kind of conventional attack, which is an attack upon a nuclear plant or a nuclear installation. I think that is a real danger. And if that happened, of course, the scale of terrorist violence and the scale of response would be escalated to something that we've never seen in history before. And so one hopes and prays that that won't come about. I think in terms of the level of violence short of nuclear terrorism, although statistically it's still incredibly unlikely that, for example, someone in the United States will be killed by terrorism, and thankfully it's statistically very unlikely that will happen, it is also true that the numbers of terrorist incidents have actually risen since 2001 across the world rather than fallen. If you look at the figures both for the deaths caused by terrorism and the number of incidents of terrorism recorded each year, ironically they've actually increased during the war on terror rather than decreased. Now that's still doesn't mean that Americans should go out to work worrying about a terrorist attack. It's very unlikely they'll be attacked. On the other hand, it does mean that there's been something, I think, wrong in the way in which we've actually dealt with this problem since the atrocities of 2001, in that our policies have been very energetic and expensive and coordinated and ambitious, but actually we haven't lowered the number of terrorist attacks. We've actually raised them.
And how can we address that in terms of policy?
I would argue that there are a number of things which can effectively be done and which involve a kind of prioritizing of certain ways of responding over others. I would argue, for example, that generally the gaining and sustaining of high-quality detailed intelligence is far, far more useful than the use of the military in terms of dealing with terrorism. I think if you look, for example, at the conspiracy which led to the 9/11 attacks, much of that, as we know, was done by al-Qaeda, who are grouping in Afghanistan. In Afghanistan, between when the Soviets left and when 9/11 happened, there was virtually no U.S. intelligence presence at all. We just didn't look at what was happening there, and we took our eyes off the ball, and we lost sight of what was happening. I think that intelligence is something which, again, we saw that in the run-up to the Iraq war, there were profound failures of intelligence in terms of weapons of mass destruction, in terms of opinion in Iraq as to what would happen after the invasion and after the war. And I think in those ways, we've probably prioritized a muscular military response rather than prioritizing the painful and quiet gathering of intelligence. Now, I think that's changing now, but by the time it's changed, the problem has got worse. Again, I think we should probably resort less to extending legal possibilities and powers and regulations than we do. There's a tendency after terrorist attacks to say we must make make the law much, much more flexible, must give much greater powers to the police, must give much greater powers to judges. And sometimes that works, but quite often it doesn't. Quite often it means that people look at the country which is opposing terrorism and they see things like abuses in Abu Ghraib prison, they see things like the Guantanamo Bay detainees, and it almost gives a propaganda victory to the other side. What I would tend to argue is that when you've got a terrorist crisis, you should concentrate on high-quality intelligence, on emphasizing the political dimensions to what's going on operating within the normal way in which the law operates and within the normal powers that you have and the normal powers of detention and interrogation that you would normally use in most situations. And if you do that, although it's less emotionally satisfying than sending in the troops, it's probably going to work better.
Do we make a mistake in linking terrorist acts around the world and thinking that they all have a central cause?
I think we probably do. I mean, sometimes you do find that there are alliances where one group will ally ideologically with another, where one group will help to train or arm another. But overwhelmingly, my research would tend to suggest that if you're looking for the explanation of why things happen in Chechnya, why things happen in the Philippines, why things happen in Palestine, 90% of what you're explaining is stuff which is related to those specific contexts and those specific dynamics of those particular places. In other words, if you want to know why things are happening in a particular way in the Basque country in Spain in terms of political violence, the overwhelming explanation will lie very locally rather than in some global terrorist problem. So I would see it less as something which is like a virus which is linked around the world and which is part of the same phenomenon as separate things which originate in local situations, but which have kind of family resemblances between them in terms of some of the patterns of politics and the patterns of violence that ensue. It's less, I think, that we've got one problem across the world than that we've got lots of different problems which share this central method that people in many of these different cases think that terrorizing violence is a necessary and just way of pursuing their political goals. So I would emphasize we should look at the context of each particular place very, very closely, and then we'll know what is and what is not possible in those places.
And to the extent that most terrorism is local, as you say, it requires not only better intelligence, but a better understanding of the world, of local situations, and a less myopic view than we have often taken.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that's absolutely right, Jeff. And I think that the key thing there is to emphasize the particular histories of particular societies. I mean, I remember when I was talking in a couple of situations where there have been people from the American military there, I've always emphasized that if you are going to get involved in combating terrorizing violence in Afghanistan or in the Middle East or wherever it is, you need to understand the long and complex history of those places better than we tend to do when we engage in them. I think in that sense, we've probably got much greater knowledge and much greater resources than we think, because we have got people who study a lot of these places, we've got people who know the particular histories and nuances and complexities of those places, and we have people therefore who know the likely outcome of certain kinds of activity and intervention in those contexts, and it'll sometimes vary from one place to another what's possible. I think we need to be very sensitive about the particularities of each place and to try and respond to them in terms of what which doors you can push open in one place which might not work in others, and to act accordingly.
As we look at some of these terrorist examples from the past, are there instances in which the response has been the most effective in bringing down the terrorism more quickly? Can we look at some best practices that have happened in this regard?
I think there are two points to make there. One is that some countries, of course, use an incredibly repressive regime. We saw this in some Latin American examples. We saw it more recently in Sri Lanka, where people say, well, what we're going to do is we're just going to go in and cause mass repressive violence and stamp it out. And in some cases, to be honest, that can work. What you can do is you can crush resistance. The difficulty with that is, of course, you're not minimizing the amount of human suffering and terrorizing violence. You're just producing more of it on your own ways, and you're kind of creating the sort of society that certainly the United States would not want to create. So that's one response which I wouldn't advocate. A second response is, I think, the one where you try to be more cautious and deal with things in the sort of ways I'm advising. My experience is that most crises which are responded to in that way are responded to after a long learning process. In other words, the normal pattern is not that people get best practice straight away, but what they do is they go through the kind of making of mistakes and a heavy-handedness and transgressing legal boundaries and making clumsy errors, and then gradually learn the lessons. I think that's what's happened in Spain. I think that's what's happened in the UK with Northern Ireland. I think that's what's actually happening with the war on terror now. So depressingly, what happens is we don't go so much to the right answer straight away. We kind of learn it slowly, which of course is a very human phenomenon. Part of the reason I've written this new book is to try and say, look, if there were some terrorist atrocity tomorrow in the United States, for example, on praise and hopes there won't be, but if there were, what would be the best responses? What would be a kind of kit of things we should know that we should do and what we should not do. And to the extent that you can learn from the lessons of history, I think it's worth trying to set what those are. Not that I'm confident that people would necessarily listen to a professor and say we should do this, but rather that you can contribute to the debate and say, look, let's not make the same kinds of mistakes as were made in Algeria, as were made when people were dealing with Chechnya, as were made in the war on terror. Let's try and get straight to the best practice and try and deal with this in calm ways which might have some greater effectiveness.
Richard English. The book is Terrorism, How to Respond. It's just published by Oxford University Press. Richard, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Jeff. I enjoyed that. Thank you.
Thank you.